So I wanted to thank the organizers for the invitation. It's been a lot of fun at this meeting. So I wanted to talk a little bit about entropy. There's this memorable quote by Eddington that the law of that entropy always increases holds a supreme position. And if your theory is against the second law of thermodynamics, there's nothing but to collapse in the deepest humiliation. You're done for. But if you take the second law to mean that entropy always increases, then that's simply not true. We know that Poincaré recurrences will happen and drive entropy from any value, in particular equilibrium, down to any low number that you want. We also know that in microscopic systems, entropy decrease does occur. This is an experimental demonstration of violation of the second law of thermodynamics in small systems. And so the way that we currently think about, the modern way of thinking about the second law is not that it's an absolute entropy always increases, but that the probability of entropy decreasing over some time period, say, relative to it increasing is exponentially suppressed in the entropy decrement versus increase. So it's a statistical law, and it admits exponentially suppressed violations of entropy increase. Now, I've been thinking, and indeed, although in microscopic systems these can happen, we think that in macroscopic systems this exponential suppression will be so strong that we're never going to observe entropy decrease in anything in any significant way. The timescales are simply unimaginably long. But unimaginably long is total child's play compared to eternity. So since I've been thinking about eternal inflation for a number of years, I've also been thinking about a lot of processes that have this character to them, that they actually include decreases in entropy. And these are things like transitions between inflationary vacua, the Hawking-Moss transition, there's a part of Coleman-DeLucia, the Lean-Weinberg process, stochastic eternal inflation. Many of you will know exactly what all these things are, but I'll go through them later. And also things, processes like the nucleation of stuff in thermal spaces, thermal ADS or Minkowski or de Sitter space, like black holes or just blobs of stuff. We've talked about Boltzmann's rain, and even we could fluctuate a whole cosmological space. And at some point a few years ago, I realized that the way that I was thinking about these processes, like what actually happened in these processes as entropy was decreasing from equilibrium, say, to some lower value, was just wrong. I was not thinking about it the right way. And I realized what the right way to think about it was, and convinced myself that that was true. So at some point, so I'd kind of mulled through what implications this would have for cosmology. At some point, I called up the two people who I know who think most about this stuff, and I asked Sean whether he agreed with this and whether he could tell me what I could reference for this understanding of how entropy decreases, and he told me he agreed, but the only place he knew it written down was in his book, which I obviously hadn't read, even though he had sent me the chapters months ago. So we got to thinking about, you know, let's actually think through this argument in more detail, and how could we apply it to cosmology. So let me tell you what I think is in pictures, the right way to think about it, then in hand-wavy arguments, then in a better argument, and then apply it to some applications. So in pictures, let's imagine that we have a grand piano that's just sitting in a box. Let's make this box totally impenetrable. We could even identify the space if we wanted to make it really closed. So we want a system of finite entropy, and then we're just going to let it sit there forever. So after some large amount of time, particles will knock bits of the piano off. There may even be quantum tunneling that lets particles out. Some energy will be released. The room will heat up. The decay will get quicker. Eventually, the piano will decay to the point where it falls down. If there's gravity, if we add gravity to this thing, or this, you know, first the strings will snap and we'll hear some sounds. If we keep waiting, the piano will further decay, and eventually we'll end up with some hot gas that's in nuclear statistical equilibrium. If there's, say, proton decay, then all the baryons will decay away, and we'll end up with just some gas of neutrinos and electrons and photons and whatnot. The entropy increase during this process we've estimated as being going from something like 10 to the 26th to 10 to the 39. So it's a big entropy increase. And now the question is, if we now let that box sit there forever, and we just wait for, we want to wait for a piano to fluctuate out of that box, what kind of stuff will we see? Well, the most common kind of stuff we'll see is probably just little local fluctuations in the density of gas in the box, which will then quickly return to the equilibrium configuration. If we wait a really, really long time, we could get some interesting macroscopic fluctuation with some mass, say a little frog. Frog dies, goes back to equilibrium. We wait for many, 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 exponentially many frogs, and we might get a bowl of petunias that has a bigger mass. And if we keep waiting, we might get something, and each time returning to equilibrium exponentially many times, we might get something like a big blob of the gas with a similar mass of the piano. We might even get a decayed piano if we wait a few, you know, exponentially many more cycles of this going back to equilibrium in similar configurations. We'll get a less decayed piano. And if we wait an incredibly long time, we get the full piano. And the contention that we want to put forth is that this is actually exactly the way that the piano would most probably be reconstructed. That is, that we would construct, that we would have a decayed piano, a less decayed piano. This piano would, in some funny event, have heat that gathers itself up and thrusts the piano up in the air. It would start to reassemble itself. Sound waves would converge from the edges of the room to excite strings. It would kind of whip around and then fuse together into strings of the piano. It would finally polish itself up, and we'd end up with the piano that we have. So, in other words, that the fluctuation from this box of gas to the piano is essentially just the time reverse of the way that that piano decayed from its original state to equilibrium in great detail. So I'm going to give you a hand-wavy argument for why we think this is true, then a more rigorous argument, and then some stories using this way of reasoning about these cosmological processes. So the hand-wavy argument is really simply this, that if we start out with some macro state, we'll call it A naught in general here, then I can think of this as being composed of a bunch of microstates that all trace out some trajectories. And I can then just follow where those trajectories go. If I wait long enough, essentially all of them are going to end up here at equilibrium. And this is the normal evolution, say, of the piano to equilibrium. But now I want to ask this different question of, if I have equilibrium and I've chosen some macro state that I want to wait for it to be realized, how do I get there? Well, I want to look for paths that went, all the paths that just went from equilibrium, did whatever they will, and end up here. So I want to know those. But if I assume that the physics really is time symmetric here, then for each solution like this that goes from A naught to equilibrium, there is an equally valid time reverse solution that goes essentially from equilibrium to A naught. If I collect all those together, they form exactly the set of trajectories that goes from equilibrium to A naught. In other words, all I have to do is flip this thing upside down to get the set of micro trajectories that I want that go from equilibrium to A naught. So that's a basic argument, that since the micro trajectories and their probability distribution in particular is going to be exactly the same here as here, once I coarse grain into macro states, the probability distribution of the macro states is also going to do the same thing. Now, this is rough, and it's also not quite right, because it's not quite true in general that if I time reverse this macro state, I will get the same macro state back. If this macro state is something where something's moving to the right, if I time reverse it, it's moving to the left. I have to send P to minus P. And this is kind of hand-wavy. So let's do it in a little bit more detail. So in a little bit more detail, we think about let's think as a toy model about some finite set of states, microstates, little a sub I, with probabilities, little p sub I. there's no difficulty in generalizing this to a continuous but finite phase space or to quantum mechanics, but we're just going to treat these kind of little classical states for now. We can partition these into some set of macro states, capital A sub J, and the probability of a macro state is just given by summing over the probabilities of the micro states that are in that macro state. Now, the micro states we're assuming evolve by some unitary operator, and the particular, in particular, the feature that we are going to assume is that for each trajectory A of t, which is given by choosing a little a and then evolving it using this unitary operator, there's an a bar of minus t that's given by some map, we'll call it the bar map, from a to a bar, and then it's evolution by the unitary operator that's also a solution. So this bar is just some involution that maps the full state space onto itself, such that when you do it twice, you get back to the original state. Well, exactly that there is a, essentially that there's a map that at any given time assigns, so just that at a single, if I take this state at this time, there is a map that, an invertible map that goes from A to A of T. The particular, so that map has to be invertible. The particular property that we're going to want is this one. Yeah. Can you say that again? No, we don't. So as I said, we can generalize all this to quantum mechanics or to a continuous set of states. The key thing is that we have a, so in quantum mechanics it really is a unitary operator. The key thing is that we have this map. In quantum mechanics, this map will be CPT rather than, well, CP really, and it'll be perfectly defined. So once we know our evolution operator, then we know how these probabilities for the microstates evolve, because they basically, once you know how each microstate evolves, you know how the probability for the microstates evolves. And at any given time, I can then add those up and find the probability for the macrostates. So we also know the evolution of the macrostate probability distribution. And we can accord both microscopic and coarse-grained entropy to these two probability distributions, the little ones and the big ones. We know from the Liouville theorem in classical mechanics or analogs, if we generalize, that this micro entropy is going to be conserved. The coarse-grained entropy is the one that likes to increase. So I can illustrate the basic ideas here with this diagram. So the idea is this is our big phase space, which I've coarse-grained into these cells, which I've labeled, you know, A sub something. If we start out with a laboratory system, say in some macro state A naught, that might be here. This is some trajectory that just wanders out of A naught. A laboratory system, we assume something somewhat special about the microstates that are in this A naught, which is that they came from lower entropy macrostates. So it was a trajectory like this. A more generic one, of course, would have come from a higher entropy past. This is the past hypothesis that has been discussed. We're going to make the assumption, which is generally made, it's called Onziger's regression hypothesis, which I thought was a very fun name, that doesn't matter. In other words, that if we take accord equal probability to all of the microstates compatible with this macrostate and evolve it forward, we will get essentially the same statistical predictions as if we had picked the small subset of these which are compatible with the past hypothesis. So that hypothesis is that a macrostate that sort of has equal probability for the microstates will behave in the same way as a macrostate that is prepared in the laboratory. So in principle, that could not be true, but it seems to be true in Onziger's regression hypothesis. Now in this map, I've shown this involution of bar is represented by a reflection across this I axis. So A bar is, A4 bar is A, is that. If I think of some trajectories, then if I have, say, this micro trajectory that goes along here, then if I bar that micro trajectory, it comes here, and its evolution looks like this one. So now the question we want to ask is, let's start in equilibrium. And I should note that this could be a metastable equilibrium as well, as long as the decay time is long compared to the time it takes to fluctuate the thing that I'm interested in. So it doesn't have to be the true equilibrium. I'm going to wait till some macro state, big A naught, is realized and call this time T0. Then I'm going to ask, what is the probability distribution over macroscopic histories such that at time T0 I'm definitely in the macro state that I chose, and that the probability distribution of micro histories is evenly divided over the micro states compatible with that macro state that I'm interested in. It's not clear what else I could hypothesize other than this. So the answer to that is, so consider the bar of big A naught, that is the a set that is composed of the bars of all the individual A's that were in the unbarred A naught. And we're going to assume that when we bar a macro state, it turns into another macro state that was in our original partition. I think that's a small assumption, and we don't actually quite need it, but it does make things nicer to describe. So let's just assume that. So I have this A bar naught, that's some macro state. Now I'm just going to ask how that naturally evolves to equilibrium by just the same sorts of arguments. I start out in that macro state, I give equal probability to each of the micro states, I watch where they go, and I compute statistics over the macroscopic probability, the probability distribution over the macro states given that set of micro trajectories. So I have a set of probabilities for the macro trajectories that are evolved from A naught bar. Now just bar this whole thing. So bar all of the individual micro trajectories. And by this assumption, I can also bar all of the macro trajectories. So this is now a set of macroscopic histories leading up to A naught. So I've double barred A, so it's A naught, so it's now A naught again, such that each microstate making up A naught is equally probable. And that's exactly what I asked for. So this prescription is the way to compute the set of macroscopic histories that I've asked for. So in pictures, I ask, how did I get into this state, this macro state, big A naught? So I bar that, so I look for all of the, so I look at this macro state. I look at the evolution of all the microstates that go out of this. So this is one example of that one. So I trace all those. Then I take all those traced out histories and bar them all. So they give me things like this. And that is the set of histories that I was interested in, the ones that go from equilibrium to A naught. So the prescription is that I take this macroscopic conjugate, and then I see how it evolves. So applied to the piano, I would take, you know, technically an anti-piano. If it was moving to the right, I would start with one that was moving to the left. Yeah. Yeah. I don't have to worry about the bars. Right. Right. So I should have mentioned we call that a bounce state. So if A bar equals A, then you don't have to worry about the bars and things are a little simpler. And I'll give examples of both types. So if we can bar the piano, and if we can know what the barred piano will do, and in this case an anti-piano moving to the left, we're going to assume will decay in basically the same way as a piano moving to the right. We follow that. That gives us a probability distribution over trajectories. It's not exact. You know, different strings might break in different histories and so on first, and it might, you know, different legs might break first. But we have a a probability distribution, and that is the same probability distribution that will govern how we get back to the piano. There will be very tiny probability for events like this whole box of gas suddenly fluctuates into piano, just in the same way that there's a tiny possibility that the piano will spontaneously just combust into a box of gas. So those probabilities will be exactly corresponding. So just to emphasize the assumptions we made, it's a system with a fixed set of microstates. A particular reversible evolution operator, that is, the theory has this basically a time symmetry, some set of macrostates, and democracy of microstates given a choice of the coarse-grained macrostates. Now, we want to apply this to other systems that we don't quite know how to write down the fundamental physics laws for, including gravity. So we have to make some other assumptions which are a bit shakier, but there are reasonable arguments for. One assumption we'll make is that fixed systems, including gravity, also obey these same assumptions. And the second assumption is that in the processes that we're going to be discussing, we can create a fixed physical system by considering the interior of the causal diamond of some particular time-like observer. We're going to treat this as a closed gravitating system with a fixed set of states. It is, yeah. Yeah, so in quantum mechanics, what we'll do is start out with some macrostate which we describe by a density matrix. And that density matrix precisely corresponds to the little piece of eyes that we had before. And we evolve that density, we can let that density matrix evolve, and it's microscopically its entropy is conserved, but if we do some kind of coarse graining, then we will still have an entropy that will increase. So we still have to coarse grain. So it should. So if we're considering, I mean, maybe we should talk about this later, or when we talk about the cosmological ones, but. I mean, if we're talking about a box of gas, it really is the equilibrium configuration of that box of gas, whether you treat it classically or quantum mechanically. There is a macroscopic equilibrium state of that. Maybe I should get to the gravitating examples, but if you're starting, so I think there is a, I think we can treat the false vacuum De Sitter space, I mean, it's a metastable De Sitter space, but we can treat that like an equilibrium system. And we're going to fluctuate things within that thermal system, which, as I'll describe. Yeah, maybe I should go on and we can talk either later in this talk or afterwards in more detail. So our assumption is going to be that we can treat gravitating systems in essentially the same way, that we can talk about an equilibrium state, and that we can talk about make the same assumptions about that it's a system with a finite phase space that evolves by the same sort of reversible operator. So I'm going to talk about various systems. For a number of them, it will be useful to think about this toroid double well potential, where I've labeled some things like the false vacuum and the true vacuum, and maybe a start and end point of an instanton, the maximum, some maybe inflationary thing here. I haven't drawn this the right shape for that, but just pretend. So the first thing we could talk about is, suppose we just have some region of De Sitter space. The field is sitting in some vacuum that might be true or false. And we just want to wait until we thermally fluctuate some blob where the scalar field is some spherically symmetric blob where the scalar field takes some value in the middle. We can do that, and in fact, we can, if we wait a while, we can fluctuate a particularly interesting blob, which is one that is static. So here, we're assuming that this blob is much smaller than the horizon, so we're thinking about this just in flat space. But we're assuming that the fluctuations are small in some sense compared to the classical evolution. So we can think of this as kind of a classically evolving thing that will have these little perturbations here and there that are not included in the picture that I will show. But we can ask, so one configuration we can be interested in is this little blob that's here, and this is a static configuration. If we perturb it a tiny bit, it will be not quite static and will either recollapse and then kind of slosh around in this potential well, and then, or it can, if we perturb it the other way, it could slosh out this way, if I had started it in the false vacuum, and this would represent a decay channel for this false vacuum. Now, I want to ask, how would that blob actually come to be out of this equilibrium state? And the prescription that we're putting forth is that I just take the bar of this. When I take the bar of this, it does nothing because this is a static configuration. I know how it evolves forward. Then I just time reverse that to get this configuration that led up to it. So the history that leads up to this configuration is these little fluctuations converge, and they start exciting the field that sloshes around in this potential well until it excites it enough that it reaches over a little bit and precisely attains this static configuration. And if it was precisely static and there were little perturbation, it could slosh out and you would have this decay channel for the false vacuum. So this we would claim is the most probable. Of course, there will be fluctuations around this, but insofar as there is a well-defined history this way, there will also be a well-defined history this way, and that this is what the evolution looks like. So the next example is Kolmogorov-DeLucia tunneling. Now here, this is the standard Kolmogorov-DeLucia instanton, which includes the part that relaxes to the true vacuum inside of this bubble. On the other pole is this other half of the instanton that relaxes from the start point back to the false vacuum. We're only, again, considering the part of the spacetime within the causal diamond of an observer, which we've now put at the North Pole. Now, the way that this tunneling is normally interpreted is that the reason the tunneling doesn't start at the false vacuum is because there's a little thermal activation that brings the field basically up to this starting point, then it tunnels through, and then it rolls down the other side. And there's a nice paper by Brown and Weinberg where they do this in some detail. And they argue, and we agree with the prescription, that the field configuration that you actually tunnel from is exactly essentially this one, the one that holds on the south side of the instanton, this field configuration here. So what we're asking is not about the quantum tunneling, but how thermally do we produce the pre-tunneling field configuration? And that's a question that we can answer with our prescription, which is that we see how it evolved to equilibrium, time reverse that, and that's what it looks like. So here, we're sitting here, we see this in one coordinatization at least, homogeneous field just rolling up the hill until it gets here, then we notice that our slicing didn't actually cover the whole space and that there's this other stuff around, and then it tunnels. Now, Hawking Moss, this is one of the processes that's been confusing for quite a while, at least to some people, including me, for quite a while. Hawking Moss is something where we can think of it as a limit of Coleman Deluche. If we make the potential flatter and flatter at the top, then the instanton endpoints migrate upward. In doing so, the Lorentzian version of the instanton looks like the wall is just getting thicker and thicker and more homogeneous. And in the limit, we have Hawking Moss where the instanton is all just sitting up here. And the limit of Coleman Deluche that looks like that is just the wall has become perfectly large, filling the whole horizon volume and homogeneous. So we can think of Hawking Moss as sort of this limit of Coleman Deluche in this sense. And again, the prescription would be that if we're sitting here, we essentially just roll up the hill to get here, and then we might either roll back down again or roll down into the true vacuum. Now, this is not quite right because the drawing pictures like this assumes that there is a dominant classical history, whereas we know that in the Hawking-Moss limit is the same limit in which fluctuations become comparable to classical evolution. So there is no sharply defined classical history. In fact, we would have to, there's just some probability distribution over things that might look something like this. So this is one possible realization of it, but the real picture would have sort of similar probabilities for many variations upon this sort of process. And that leads us naturally to something like stochastic eternal inflation, where we really just want to think of everything as being dominated by the fluctuations in the field. There's a nice way of looking at this. So if we coarse grain over a Hubble size, a Hubble volume, we can treat the field value of that Hubble volume, and we can treat the quantum, the thermal fluctuations or the quantum fluctuations as just this noise term. This is the Langevin approach. And there's a nice paper by Grattan and Turok who work out analytically the predictions of this for the lambda phi to the fourth model. And they find that there's, you can compute exactly if you start at some point, say up here, or maybe up here, you can look at the mean and the variance of the trajectories going away from that. So this is the mean, and then the other dashed lines are the variance. Time is running, in this case, this way. Now we want to ask, what is the probability distribution over histories that if we started down at the true vacuum and just waited for a really long time for things to fluctuate up here, and what would the PDF of histories be like? Well, Matt has actually calculated it, so he just ran this a zillion times, picked out the ones that landed up here, asked where were they before, and then computed the statistics of them, and you can see that. So these are the statistics, and now time is running to the right. These are the ones that ended up at this field value. You can see that they're exactly the statistics that were computed for the field going down in the Langevin approach. You can't quite do it analytically going upward because things become singular in their approach at the true vacuum, but you can do it numerically anyway. So you can see that the behavior that we expected is coming directly out of this. This would happen at any time you had sort of a Brownian motion process. I think the calculation would be essentially the same. So you can get some sort of insight into what it looks like when you fluctuate up the hill. Insofar as the fluctuations got small and insofar as there was a well-defined trajectory going down, the way that you got up the hill would just be the time reverse of that. So you would just roll up the hill. Now let me turn from these cosmological processes for a short time to fluctuating other interesting stuff out of a thermal background. So one thing you can think of fluctuating out of a thermal background is a black hole. This is kind of a frustrating thing for our process because our prescription says, okay, take your black hole, time reverse it, and then see how it evolves. So you time reverse a black hole and you get a white hole, and then you ask what comes out of the white hole. Well, that's exactly what you don't know. right? So we don't know, we can't say how a black hole generically forms out of equilibrium using this prescription. We can cheat a little bit, and we can say, okay, well, let me pick a particular subclass of those, which is, let's say I create a cloud that then falls in to form a black hole. That I can do. So if I create a cloud that is, say, a dust cloud at some fixed radius that is just going to collapse into a black hole, I could ask, how did that form? Because that's something I can time reverse and evolve. The time reverse evolution is just that it collapsed and fell into a black hole. So if I then time reverse that and glue it onto the bottom, I have something that looks like a white hole that spews out this dust cloud, which leaves the white hole horizon, turns around, forms a black hole, and Hawking evaporates. Note that the white hole forms by Hawking condensation, I guess. And this is an interesting implication, I think, that if we wait long enough in some thermal space for a white hole to form, which is going to happen, then there is a very particular way by which it happens, which is that you have this spherically symmetric thermal radiation coming in from infinity that slowly accretes on and builds up the white hole in this very particular way, which is, the time reverse of the black hole evaporation. So while we don't know the generic formation process of a black hole, we do know it for a white hole. It's this very particular thing. So that's maybe less useful, I don't know, but I think probably the nucleation rate of white holes and black holes will be just about the same, so we should be thinking about that. Yeah, the problem is that, yeah, I think we just don't know. I think realistically there are many different ways that you can form. I think this is telling you that there are just many different ways you could form black holes out of equilibrium. There isn't a particularly well, sharply defined one. Yeah, those are all in, but they're very suppressed. I mean, the you're saying that black holes don't decay by a the simplicity of black hole decay by Hawking radiation is based on a particular. Right. Well, I might say that they throw lots of different. I'm not sure. Maybe we should talk about this later. I'll try to understand what you mean. Now, one problem with that picture before was that it manifestly was. This is not a unitary type of process. The information goes away. It does not really fit our set of definitions. If we want to think about a black hole that doesn't have these singularities where the information goes away, I'm not sure exactly how to draw a conformal diagram for that. This is the best we could do, inspired by some papers that are in the literature, is something like this, where you might start out with a dust ball that falls inside an apparent horizon. There's some region where gravity is strongly quantum that we can't really draw on this diagram, but we can draw kind of up close to it and then shade it out. So the apparent horizon forms, the dust ball falls within it. There's, for a long time, the apparent horizon is the same as the event horizon you would expect, but there's no real event horizon, then the black hole evaporates. And so again, our prescription would say that the way this particular configuration would generically form is by white hole condensation, which then ejects that thing. We can think of another fun thing to think about is eternal black holes in ADS, where a black hole or thermal ADS may be the equilibrium state, and there could be transitions between the two. This diagram was fun to draw, but it will take a long time to explain, so I'm going to leave that aside and refer you to the paper. Another kind of fun one that just to illustrate the importance of the bounce, or the bounce assumption, is the island universe. This is an idea, you could call it the Boltzmann's universe in some sense. This is the idea that the whole observable universe just at some point spontaneously fluctuated out of De Sitter space at some early fireball stage. Now, if we have an expanding fireball, and you can kind of write down a construction for this where you match the interior fireball to a Schwarzschild De Sitter outside and so on. This has been done. But if you take an expanding fireball and time reverse it, you don't get another expanding fireball. You get a contracting fireball. So we have to think of what happened to that. So the contracting fireball, if we evolve it forward in time, would have some growing perturbations. It would eventually form a big black hole, which would then, if as long as this whole thing can fit inside the De Sitter radius, would then evaporate into De Sitter space. So to get the generic formation history of this fireball out of De Sitter, we would have this time reverse where we'd have this big white hole that condenses out of De Sitter space and at some point ejects this thing with big perturbations, which would then shrink to meet the specification that you made here. And so this story is markedly different from the one that's given in that paper as to how this happens. So I believe that this is the better description. There are, of course, certain grave problems that many of you will be concerned about a cosmology like this that fluctuates out of equilibrium. And you can make those particularly clearly in this case, but let's not do that now. I'll just move on. So the final example I'll give is the reverse Coleman-DeLucia process. So this is one that confused me for a long time because it's a process where you go from the true vacuum to the false vacuum. It's a huge true vacuum region, which you replace with basically a tiny false vacuum horizon size. So this always seemed very strange to me. This is this massive fluctuation that takes this huge region and replaces it with this tiny one. But from this point of view, it's not particularly weird. I mean, it is very weird, but not in the same way. So essentially, you have equilibrium. Time reverses, in a sense. You start to slowly roll up the hill and deflate. If there was a history of cosmology like ours, you'd have to go through the whole history of galaxy destruction and combination and stuff like that, and cooling, de-reheating, cooling, I don't know, and deflation. You would then at some point, I don't think you could actually see it, but it would look like there was this wall coming in from the horizon, this bubble wall that came in from the horizon. You'd find yourself in this small bubble of instanton endpoint value, which would then have the opportunity to quantum tunnel through and disappear into the false vacuum. Otherwise, exponentially many times, one over the tunneling rate sort of many times it would just roll down again and you'd be really disappointed, but every now and then you'd get to create the false vacuum. So this is an incredibly weird process, but in some sense more sensible. It's a perfectly consistent picture. It's just so incredibly improbable that basically anything else will happen in this background space before this does. Just a few quick notes on cosmology. So I think we should not... From this point of view, I think we should not really think of upward tunneling as just like downward tunneling, but less probable, where we have some space that up tunnels and then we let it inflate and it's just like and we just plug it into our matrix equations and so on, but with a tiny rate. It's really more like a time reverse process. I think it's likely that I also think. This is a slightly different point maybe I'll skip that point. Those of you who are interested in this stuff can read that. And just a few more general points. Internal inflationists, I think, tend to reward inflation for producing infinite volume out of a false vacuum. So this is the idea that even though it's hard to create some false vacuum region, once you do, you get an infinite payoff. This seems a little bit unfair to me from this standpoint, because you're giving this infinite payoff to out of creating the false vacuum, but you're not charging an infinite price to make the false vacuum, right? So if you were in a finite system, that's exactly what you would do. You're not going to get more out of this than you put in. So it's not clear to me whether this is really cheating in some way, but then it's not exactly clear to me how to think about these gravitating systems if they're bigger than the horizon size, and how to think about our prescription and so on. So I can't say it's wrong, but it does smell a little funny once you start thinking about things in this way. So the summary, I think, is that this basically one sentence, which is that evolution from equilibrium to a chosen macro state, A, is the time reverse of the evolution from A's time reverse to equilibrium, with the following explanations of individual points. And this allows us, I think, to understand various processes in ultra-long-lived systems like an eternal inflation, or for microscopic processes, actually, too. And it's not clear to me that this has actually been done in microscopic systems. Then it might lead us to some useful new insights beyond just storytelling. So I encourage you to give it a try. Thanks.
Okay, questions for Anthony. We'll start up here.
Yeah, thanks, Anthony, for making that very, that was very nice with the very clear assumptions. I think my intuition is that for the piano example, that the conclusion is wrong, because although certainly Canada and the U.S. are democracies, I don't think there's democracy of microstates. In other words, I don't believe in this example in the Onsacker regression hypothesis, because I think, well, it depends how finely you do the coarse grading, but I think if you did the coarse grading so that you look at the piano and maybe look at the gas around the little blobs and see, is it mostly atoms and so on, you'd find there's a lot more microstates in which some of the atoms have been converted into radiation. And so so depending on how finely you fix the state of the piano, it may not be at all like what we would get with the past hypothesis. With the past hypothesis, we have very little of these high energy photons running around that you get if the whole thing decayed. So if you just want to get to a macro state in which we have something that looks like a piano and looks crudely like gas there, but you don't disallow the possibility of a bunch of high energy photons that could vastly increase the entropy, then I think you could form the piano much faster out of a thermal state than the rate it would decay from our state that has the past hypothesis. So I think it's very beautiful, and I don't know. I'd be curious to see if other people have shown there's problems with this Onsager regression hypothesis. But
not
I think
that
in
I know,
the piano example, I just don't believe it.
Yeah, so far as I know, the Onsager regression hypothesis is kind of a standard assumption in statistical mechanics that people use in these fluctuation theorems and so on. But it is true that if I don't know how to evolve, so if I want to fluctuate an A, I do have to specify something about what that means. So if I just want to fix the macro state A, then it's not clear what else I can do other than assume equal probability for the microstates. I mean, I could assume something more, but that would just be something I'm putting in. So if that's the case, then I simply have to know how A bar evolves under democracy of states. Now, it may be that that is not the way, that does not accord with our normal intuition for the way things evolve. That's possible. I'm doubtful, but it is possible. And in that case, it's true that you would have to, rather than the ordinary way things evolve, figure out how that state with democracy of states would evolve. And that would be, how you compute this. So, yes, there may be detailed, there may be questions about whether that hypothesis is true in particular systems, but that is, that's the assumption.
So I think I agree with Don that even